From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the predictions of psychic Elizabeth Joyce. Here's what's happening. Well, leaders in China almost immediately expressed outrage at a new report indicating that the United States, us, has secretly stationed forces on Taiwan already in an attempt to bolster the island's national defenses against the increasing likelihood of an attack from China. The Wall Street Journal first reported that a small unit of special forces have been based in Taiwan for at least a year to train local military forces, a move China has previously said would violate agreements between Washington and China. The Zodiac Killer case apparently remains open. The FBI has confirmed one day after the decades-old crime mystery drew widespread media attention when an independent group revealed the name of a man it believes responsible for several murders in the San Francisco area. A group called the Casebreakers named Gary Poste as the elusive Zodiac, who is linked to five killings in the late 1960s. The killer claimed to have murdered at least 37 people and taunted authorities over several years with letters and ciphers that left Bay Area residents fearful. Well, on Thursday, the FBI said, nope, the case is still open. Poste is dead, by the way. IBM and American Airlines have put their unvaccinated employees on alert, with IBM threatening that workers who aren't fully vaccinated by December 8 will be placed on unpaid suspension, and American warning that those who don't have COVID-19 jabs by November 24th will face the axe. Two real-world studies confirm that the immune protection offered by two doses of Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine drops off after 2 months or so, although they say protection against severe disease, hospitalization, and death still remains strong. The studies are from Israel and Qatar. Pfizer and BioNTech have asked U.S. regulators to authorize emergency use of their COVID-19 vaccine for children ages 5 to 11, a group of whom no shot is currently allowed. Heart damage from COVID-19 extends well beyond the disease's initial stages, according to a study that found even people who were never sick enough to need hospitalization are in danger of developing heart failure and deadly blood clots a year later. Merck's announcement that its antiviral COVID pill had halved hospitalizations in a trial of high-risk COVID-19 patients was met with enthusiasm today, inspiring a vision of a world in which treating a COVID-19 infection could be as trivial as swallowing a few pills. However, some scientists who have studied the drug warn that the method it uses to kill the virus that causes COVID-19 carries potential dangers that could limit the drug's usefulness. Let's check in with Christian Wild, author of Hidden Causes of Heart Attack and Stroke. Kristen, what do you think of this pill?
Well, as Merck is preparing to present their new COVID pill for FDA emergency approval, an article in Barron's indicated not so fast and carried this alert. Scientists warn Merck's COVID pill could pose serious risks. Dr. Raymond Shinazi, professor of pediatrics and director of the Division of Biochemical Pharmacology at Emory University, warned of an increased cancer or birth defect risk reported in the Barron's article. But fortunately, there's another pill candidate from Pfizer, also in the approval pipeline. So both Merck and Pfizer are in a race to get FDA approval for the pill to be administered at the first sign of the virus symptoms, and is designed, George, to limit hospitalizations and actual death. So if one of the two gets approved, it would be some very positive, finally, some positive COVID news. What makes this Merck study intriguing is the fact that COVID and the variant Delta are viral conditions, and the Merck approach with their drug is an antiviral offering. It might be worth noting more than 12 studies have also found the antiviral properties of the spice turmeric helpful in in combating the virus. Now, while Merck's study found impressive results showing a 50% reduction in hospitalizations and deaths from the virus, in contrast, the Pfizer COVID pill documented 90% fewer hospitalizations and deaths from the virus. Anything that ultimately works would be a plus plus.
I'm going to stick with turmeric, vitamin C, and zinc.
I like that.
All right, my friend, Christian Wild. Kevin Randall, of course, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, served in Vietnam, looks at UFOs for us weekly. Kevin, hello there, and what do you got for us this week?
Hey, George, how's it going?
Good.
Well, as you know, I'm a fan of multiple chains of evidence, especially when there's instrumentality involved.
Yes, you are.
The idea of gathering the evidence without human interaction is part of the theory behind the MADAR network run by Fran Ridge. I mention all this because on September 6th of this year, the MADAR node 21 in Indiana experienced a possible anomaly at 6:26 in the morning. There were readings that suggested something nearby for a period of 23 seconds. We don't have to estimate the length of time because that was all recorded automatically. The node operator used Facebook to request that anyone who had seen anything strange that morning get in touch with him. Jeff Hall, a retired police officer, was in a parking lot in the Indianapolis area facing to the west at about the same time the node alerted. He reported that he saw a black cigar-shaped craft with seven round white lights on the trailing edge. He said the UFO was flying at about 1,800 to 2,000 feet and was making no noise. He believed it to be about a half mile away and estimated the size is about 300 feet. He watched the object until he was forced to drive off and then lost sight of it. He did say he'd seen a number of objects or had seen an object like this in August. This is the second time in the last month in which there has been an anomaly detected with a corresponding sighting. Remember in the Goshen, Kentucky, the witness saw a triangle-shaped object. I reported on this a couple of weeks ago, and this suggests the MADAR system is beginning to function as Fran Ridge has planned. On October 3rd of this year, just a couple of days ago, a witness in Monmouth County, New Jersey, took a video of a UFO. He said he first noticed the light reflected on his TV screen, but it was moving around and it seemed to be changing size and shape. He used his phone to take a video of the object. It seems he was focusing on the reflection on the TV, and that does kind of reduce the importance of the video. He did have another video that he took the day before about 4 in the morning. He said he was outside looking at the stars, and they were so bright he was attempting to video them when he saw something that he described as a string of bright lights shoot across the sky. He said he was holding the camera completely still while zooming in and out. William Puckett, who analyzed the video, suggested that the motion and the changing shape of the object might be a result of the witness unconsciously moving his camera. I'll put a link to the video up on my blog. Finally, in the last week, there's been a discussion that Albert Einstein was summoned to a base in the desert southwest to examine the remains of an alien spacecraft and the bodies of the flight crew. This was first published by Len Stringfield in 1994, and UFO Magazine reported it in the mid-1990s. The investigation into this continues with many of us attempting to verify parts of the tale. I have another number of entries on my blog, including the entire text of Stringfield's report on this that includes his critical commentary there. And that's what I have for tonight, George.
All right, Kev, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks for the report. Up next, Paul David's back with us. He's a author, has written some Star Trek, Star Wars movie books. He has been all over the map, and he's with us next to talk about some incredible things, including what has happened to Timothy Leary's head. Paul David's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me introduce Paul David's, a graduate of Princeton University and the American Film Institute Center for Advanced Film Studies. He's been very active throughout his years in trying to end the official UFO truth embargo, took his efforts directly then to former President Clinton on several occasions. Paul is a filmmaker and producer. His films are known for controversy, beginning with Roswell, which he executive produced as well and co-wrote, that dealt with the 1947 Roswell UFO crash, issues of extraterrestrial life, and the purported truth embargo on the subject of ET contact. He has written a number of books on Star Wars, of course, and the film with George Lucas, and he has got a film called Timothy Leary's Dead, the psychedelic guru. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure to be invited.
I'm looking forward to this. Years ago, by the way, you and the late Rosemary Ellen Guiley conducted some work at the late Forrest Ackerman's home in Los Angeles. You remember that?
Absolutely. I'll never forget. That was after Fari had vacated the home, and we were permitted to hold a seance there.
The house was owned by a friend of mine who has since sold it after you folks were there, but he thought that you were one of the best he's ever witnessed.
Well, I really appreciate that, and he spoke so highly of you. I think that you created a website together with him, and that house, Fari, that Ackerman had lived in so many years was a repository of one of the greatest collections of science fiction memorabilia ever assembled.
He's the one who coined the phrase sci-fi, isn't he?
That's right, and I was very, very close to him. I met him when I was a teenager, actually, making amateur monster movies, and he took an interest in me as a kid and the movies I was making in 8mm. This was before video, before sound, and published me in his famous Monsters of Filmland magazine. And, you know, I got the bug in me to become a filmmaking professional and stuck with it. After going to Princeton and doing all the pre-med requirements, I decided that medical school was not for me.
Where were you born, Paul?
I was born in Washington, D.C. I grew up in the Washington suburbs in Kensington and Bethesda. My father actually was a full professor of diplomatic history at Georgetown University.
He had an
incredible career, including writing first drafts of many of the chapters for then-Senator John F. Kennedy's book, Profiles in Courage, which won the Pulitzer Prize.
That's right.
My dad was professor to Jackie Kennedy and also to Bill Clinton.
He had a lot of notoriety there, didn't he?
Yes, you know, and his being a professor to Bill Clinton opened the door for me to reach out to Bill Clinton a number of times when he was president about UFO evidence.
What did the President Clinton say about UFOs?
Well, I presented him with a couple of books in person on it, and this was at a fundraiser for Hillary when she was trying to get the Democratic nomination as opposed to Barack Obama getting it. And, you know, it was close up and personal. I reminded him who I was. He remembered my dad. He opened the envelope, looked at the books, and one of them, by Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, was Witness to Roswell, uncovering the 60-year government cover-up. And he looked at the cover, and he broke into a big smile, and he said, you know, I've always really been interested in this stuff. I'm going to read this. So... it's unfortunate that during his administration, all we got from the Pentagon was the Mogul Balloon Roswell report.
That's right.
Nobody accepts. We didn't get very far at that time. But I think he's made comments since then, and so has Barack Obama, that really let the cat out of the bag.
Paul, how have you been weathering COVID?
My wife and I have weathered it fine. We've been healthy. We did pick up and move from Los Angeles, where we've lived for so many years. You know, my wife and I are soon going to have our 50th anniversary.
That's amazing.
You heard me right. 50
almost unheard
years.
Of.
Almost unheard of. We're a couple that has stuck together through everything, and we've been very creative together. She's been a producer on many of my movies. She herself has had an absolutely incredible career at Columbia Pictures, where she was a senior vice president, and then for 25 years at Universal Pictures, senior vice president, managing all of their premieres. And I will say it's not a coincidence that Universal was the distributor, the releaser for many of the independent movies that I made.
And Hollis is her name, right?
Yes, Hollace. Oh, I wanted to say, you know, so we picked up from Los Angeles. We bought an incredible, beautiful Mediterranean-style estate in a place we've always wanted to live, Sedona, Arizona.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, to do this, well, we've had the house in Los Angeles where we raised our kids. We also have a house up in Big Bear Lake in California.
I love Big Bear. I used to go up there for a conference every January.
Well, the first time we saw this house had the address of 1024, which was our daughter's birthday, 1024 Cameron Drive. We fell in love with it. We've had it for around 15 years. It's filled with my paintings. We decided it's time to sell it. You know, it'll help us with the obligations we have for our new house in Sedona.
That's a great time to sell, though.
Yeah, mate. Mm-hmm. It's filled with my paintings. It has about 40 original paintings there.
And the paintings are going with the house?
Well, if a prospective buyer wanted to discuss that in the deal, you know, I'm open to it. So I have enough paintings. I have about 300.
Good for you. What kind of paintings did you do?
Well, I do oil paintings. And actually, there's six or seven books out under The Art of Paul Jeffrey Davids. And each one is like a different location. So one book is New York and Paris. One is my paintings of Mexico. One is the California coast, and so on. So the paintings are representational. They're of places usually that I've been to. Some are of people. You've done a wonderful portrait of one of my cinematic heroes, John Huston. And there you go. I just never quit. Always in between a movie, I've always got the paintbrushes in my hand.
Good for you. Now, what was it like writing six published books about Star Wars?
Star Wars. Not Star Trek.
Star Wars.
Star Wars. Oh, we loved it. We loved it. You know, the agent who got us that deal, Peter Miller, the literary lion, very unfortunately passed away in the last few weeks after a tremendously long battle with cancer. But Peter had introduced us to the folks up at Lucasfilm after I had been the production coordinator and a writer on the Transformers cartoons, all the original Transformer cartoons, 79 of them. I was the production coordinator at Marvel, working there when Stan Lee was there. It was wonderful. So Peter pitched Lucasfilm and said, look, Paul, you know, Transformers is all robots. You really want to see what he would do with R2-D2 and C-3PO, and he has this idea for a series of six sequel books that would take place after Return of the Jedi. So after a lot of negotiations and after some rejections from some New York publishers, finally we had the contract with Lucasfilm, and Bantam Books, part of Random House, took it on. And these books, they start with The Glove of Darth Vader, the Lossity the Jedi, Zorba the Hutt's Revenge, Mission from Mount Yoda, Queen of the Empire, Prophets of the Dark Side, all these titles. I think maybe some of your listeners grew up reading these books, or their kids.
They might have, yeah.
5 million or so sold.
That's
Can you believe
amazing.
That?
That is incredible.
And, you know, we got pennies on each book sold, but it was enough to get my kids through private school up until college. How's that?
That's exciting. Did you have fun doing it?
Oh, we loved it. You know, I was a Star Wars fan from the beginning. I always loved science fiction from childhood. You know, the special effects movies I did as a kid. Well, I want to mention an irony. I wanted to be a special effects cinematographer when I was a kid. Ended up doing directing and producing after studying at the AFI. But my son, Scott Michael Davids, first, he became an editor and edited a couple of films for Sacha Baron Cohen. My son was, I think, an associate or assistant editor on Borat, and he was a full editor on Bruno. And then he set up a special effects company, and if you check imdb.com, Scott Michael Davids now has credit as digital effects supervisor on around 40 major Hollywood films. And I think you probably heard of all of them.
That's fantastic.
Fantastic. Mainly the big comedies. But my son became, you know, instrumental in the special effects on a lot of movies you've heard of. It was always what I wanted to do. I never followed through, but he picked it up.
It's genetic.
It is genetic, yeah. You know, in fact, I want to say he helped me on my film about Timothy Leary called Timothy Leary's Dead, and he was involved with a particular special effect that we had in that movie that you and I are going to talk about, I'm sure.
When we come back after the break, Paul, we're going to talk about the Timothy Leary film and exactly that special effect, because I up until a few moments ago, I thought his head was, well, we'll talk about that. Timothy Leary, of course. Richard Nixon could not stand Timothy Leary. He thought that he was destroying America with his views on psychedelics, but you'll hear otherwise from a lot of people. In a moment, we'll come back with Paul Davids, his website, all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Timothy Leary died in 1996. Paul Davids has done a film on his life. We will talk about it. It's called Timothy Leary's Dead, and there's a very interesting surprise in that movie. Trust me, we'll talk about that when we come back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast, George Dory with you along with Paul Davids. Now, those of you who don't know the name Timothy Leary, let me tell you a little bit about him. First of all, he died in 1996, but he was a clinical psychologist at Harvard University, and he was testing the therapeutic effects of LSD. As a matter of fact, some of his own faculty members were outraged at him because he too, Timothy Leary, was trying the LSD himself. But he believed that LSD showed potential for therapeutic use in psychiatry. After he left Harvard, he continued to publicly promote the use of psychedelic drugs, and he became a well-known figure of the counterculture in the 1960s. Paul, did you know Timothy Leary?
I sure did. I sure did. I want to tell you how I met him, how I came to make the film. But I wanted to add in a few details that you left out in your summary, and that was that he didn't just leave Harvard voluntarily. He was fired from Harvard. When he was at Harvard, most of his experiments were more with psilocybin, the magic mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And then along came LSD. But he was fired along with his close associate, Richard Alpert, who later took the name Baba Ram Dass. Many people know Ram Dass, who's deceased, unfortunately. Made a great contribution. But Timothy, very controversial because whereas many of his contemporaries said, look, keep LSD a secret. This mind expansion, this extraordinary mental change that comes about from it, everybody can't handle that. So his associates like author Aldous Huxley, Humphrey Osmond, who ran the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute, where I was actually a subject in this research when I was a student at Princeton. We wrote a book about it, my co-author John Selby and I, called Blowing America's Mind. Uh-huh. But so Timothy fired from Harvard. He took the project down to Mexico, to Zihuatanejo, and spent a summer having invitees come and take LSD, learn about the psychedelics. And by the end of the second summer there, he was banned from Mexico. He was invited to take up the project at Dominican, and he was banned from there. He then went to Antigua. He was there for 2 months, started up the project, thought he had allies, then he's banned from there.
Jeez.
But the turning point for him was his friendship with Peggy Hitchcock, who was part of the Mellon family. You've heard of the Mellon Art Gallery, you know, one of the...
And the banking family.
Yes. And she had two brothers who purchased an enormous mansion in upstate New York called Millbrook. This mansion had 64 rooms, thousands of acres. I think it was a mile from the gatehouse up to the main house. And she said, look, you might be able to use this for your research, but you're going to have to turn on my brothers. So he and Richard Alpert did turn on her brothers with LSD, and they became big supporters. And they let him have the Millbrook Mansion, where he set up first the League for Spiritual Discovery, and then an organization he called IFIF, the International Foundation for Internal Freedom. And that's the focus of what Timothy Leary was about, internal freedom. That we should have the right to, if we want to use a psychedelic drug or marijuana, we should have the right to do that. It's our body. We're doing it to ourselves. Why should the government have control over this? So that was his pitch, and he brought down the wrath of the government. And that's when he started to get arrested. First in Laredo, Texas, busted for having 2 joints of marijuana, sentenced to 30 years in prison. 30 years for 2 joints that were in the possession of his daughter Susan in the car.
Which would be legal today.
Of course. Absolutely. And this 30 years, I think it was 10 years for possession, 10 years for transporting it, 10 years for not paying the tax on it. Well, a few years later, that was thrown out by the Supreme Court, but too late to help him, because meanwhile, Millbrook gets busted by G. Gordon Liddy, a massive raid on this establishment that had become a focal point for psychological research with psychedelics and had invited people of stature from around the world to come there and contribute to the studies. And they raided, they arrested him, arrested everyone else there. And while that's winding its way through the courts, he goes to California because he's out on bail. And they bust him in California at a time that he's running for governor against Ronald Reagan. And he said it was a frame-up. The cops pulled two roaches out of his ashtray. He said they weren't his roaches. The cops put them there. For that, he was sentenced to 10 years in jail. Wow. And that's when they finally sent him to prison. And then it was prison, prison, prison. He escaped. The story of his escape, extraordinary, extraordinary story. And he spent a couple, I think, years on the lam, first in Algeria with Eldridge Cleaver, then he was in Switzerland. But when he made the mistake of traveling to Afghanistan, this is way before the wars there, he was arrested by the CIA, brought back to the U.S., thrown into Folsom Prison, put in a cell next to Charles Manson. He was made an example of. Nixon called him the most dangerous man alive. He was arrested for his ideas, for his influence on the youth of the country. His ideas were considered dangerous. They wanted to keep him locked up. That's the story of Timothy Leary, a respected psychologist who started with stature at Harvard and became a convict.
Where in that life did you meet him?
I didn't meet him until after he got out of prison. And he learned that he was dying of prostate cancer.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
And his publisher at that time, who was republishing his books, a man named Sebastian Orfali of Ronin Publishing, I met him at a book convention. And he was very impressed that I was executive producer of the movie Roswell for Showtime, which, by the way, is based on a book by your friend Kevin Randall,
mm-hmm.
UFO Crash at Roswell. That's worked right. with Kevin on that. But in any event, Sebastian Orfali called me up and he said, look, it hasn't been publicly announced, but Timothy is dying. No one has made a biographical film about his life. It's now or never. He said, I could talk to him, I could pitch you, and do you think that you could get the resources together and make a film? Well, I was tremendously interested. I knew that the clock was ticking. I had to find financial resources for it. And I will say that that most of that came from a businessman named Todd Easton Mills, who's become a great friend of mine, who is also an extraordinary writer of short stories. He's had, like in F. Scott Fitzgerald, he's had 40 wonderful short stories published. But he hadn't begun writing then. He met with me, impressed with Roswell, and he said, you know, I'd like to make a movie with you. What do you got? Well, he was a conservative businessman. I thought it was impossible he'd want to do Timothy Leary. So I pitched him four other projects first, and he said, no, not right. And then I said, well, you know, what about this? I heard from Leary's publisher. How about the biography of Timothy Leary? I think we could get Leary's cooperation and do it with him. And at that, we were at the Ritz having a lunch. He pulled out his checkbook, slammed it on the table, and said, how much will it cost me and when can we start?
I love it.
So at that, called up Timothy Leary, arranged to meet him. And Leary said yes, I would say for three reasons. Sebastian Orfali had said I was the man to do it because of Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was one reason. Number two, I had worked as a subject when I was at Princeton at the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute with Leary's associate Humphrey Osmond. Osmond is the Canadian psychiatrist who invented the term psychedelic. And he respected that I knew Osmond and had worked with Osmond. So that was reason number two. And reason number three was money.
Exactly.
Timothy Leary, having been in jail and on the lam so many years, was really short on funds.
He was broke.
He was broke. He was living off of the good graces of many friends for many, many years. And Todd offered to pay him something, nice to do it. I think I spent 5 days with Timothy Leary interviewing him for hours and hours each time. We got a massive amount of material from Timothy, and it was wonderful. And I provided him with, suits to wear.
Did you like him, Paul?
I respected him enormously. I did like him. I thought he's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I mean, he's been compared. Look, people say exaggerated. You're going to compare him to Socrates? Well, Socrates was sentenced to death for corrupting the youth. Timothy Leary was incarcerated for corrupting the youth. People have compared him to Henry David Thoreau, who went to jail willingly because he refused to pay a tax to support the Mexican War. That's the kind of person Timothy Leary was. He went to jail and wrote books in jail. And he didn't hate his jailers. He said, look, they're doing their job, and I'm doing my job. And his job was to be a philosopher who was a troublemaker, who was questioning everything about our society at the time of the Vietnam War, and was offering a way into the future. I want to add that a book was written, a bibliography of his writings, of Leary's writings. Michael Horowitz put out this book. It's 300 pages long. One page about each one of Leary's books and published papers. Can you imagine that? I mean, you and I, George, we've each written a few books. Timothy Leary wrote so much that it took 300 pages just to describe what he wrote.
That's amazing.
And he's a historical figure. You know, he started out, he was an agent provocateur. Baba Ram Dass called him a perennial rascal. And he had this great influence as an icon of the counterculture, promoting LSD. He wanted to turn on the whole world. He was working with Mary Pinchot Meyer, who was a friend of President Kennedy, and she was working behind the scenes to turn on the top people in Washington with LSD. Leary believed she had turned on John F. Kennedy with LSD. They thought this was the answer to the future of world peace, that if enough world leaders experienced the ecstasy and the beauty of life through LSD, that they wouldn't possibly destroy the world with nuclear weapons. Well, that was his goal. But did I like him? You know, he was, after prison, he was crusty. He was irascible. He was argumentative. And he would jump all over me if I asked a question he didn't, like, or I phrased it wrong. But this is a great man, a great man. And why are we selling Timothy Leary's head 25 years later?
Yeah, that is, I've got to ask you that.
Why? That is 25 years.
You're auctioning off his head.
Well, it's not his real head. However, it was made from a plaster cast that he sat for.
Because he was cremated, wasn't he?
To make a perfect, perfect replica of his head. Why? Let me tell you why. And in my movie, which may be
I watched your movie. You cut his head off. I saw it in the movie.
Most all of the reviewers were convinced that he was decapitated for cryogenic freezing of the head. In the movie, he said again and again, that's his plan. That's what he wanted to do. He said the most important decision you can make in your life is how you want to die. He said you can't choose how you're born. You know, you can't choose who your parents are, but you can plan your death. And he felt that with cryogenic preservation of the brain, the head, his DNA would be preserved. There would be a chance that someday he could be brought back. And in my movie, he insists that this is what he's going to do again and again. Well, we said to ourselves, Todd Easton Mills and I, look, what if we don't actually get to be there when he dies? And this happened. Because he made a contract with the Alcor company to preserve the head.
As Ted Williams has done, right?
Yeah, Ted Williams was the whole body. And as Baba Ram Dass said, Tim didn't have the money, the $75,000 to do the whole body. He was the cheapskate who went for $25,000.
For the head.
Yeah. So all this was going to be definite, but Todd and I said, look, we may not be there to film this. This is the ending of our film. We got to show it. So Tim sat for the plaster. We plastered his whole head, and I put that in the end credits to tip off people, to hint them, don't believe everything you saw in this movie. Look, we have a mold of his head. We show his decapitation after he dies in the movie. Do you want to believe that what we were showing you was Absolutely.
It looked authentic to me.
Absolutely looked authentic. And look, 25 years later, I'm taking that head, and Heritage Auctions in Beverly Hills and Dallas is auctioning it off on their November 4th or 5th auction coming up.
What are they calling it?
What is he calling it?
Yeah, what are they calling it?
Calling it the mock-up prop head of Timothy Leary from the movie Timothy Leary's Dead. Now, nobody knew for sure until now that there even was this mock-up head. And I want to say, 25 years later, I'm doing this now. Why am I parting with this head? It's been a box in my house for 25 years. I've just shown it to a few trusted friends. It hasn't been on display. And I think now he deserves the recognition. We need to look at his life again. We need to look at his contribution. Look, almost throughout the United States, anybody can smoke marijuana now without penalty. Without penalty. Timothy Leary sentenced to 30 years in jail in Laredo for two joints. We need to look at this. What was this madness, this war on drugs from Nixon? Now, I'm not saying I support all the goals of IFIF, the International Foundation for Internal Freedom, because does that mean that we can't regulate anything that people put in their bodies? Well, maybe you have to consider in some instances there's a larger societal interest involved in these kinds of things. However, the societal interest they claimed on marijuana was like in that 1930s movie Reefer Madness, where they said, you know, the kids that smoke this marijuana, they pick up a knife and they kill people. It makes you violent. Well, it's nonsense. It's been a lie. So Timothy Leary goes to jail because of that lie? And how many others went to jail because of that?
Hold on for a second, Paul. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come back and talk more with you later on this hour. We'll take some calls. Lots more to talk about with Paul Davids on Coast to Coast AM.